Hi, I'm Michael Williams, Artistic Director of Sydney Writers Festival. We hope you enjoy this conversation recorded live at the 2021 Festival.
Okay, I'd like to acknowledge that we're on Gadigal country, and I'd like to acknowledge their sovereignty and their long history of storytelling. I'd also like to acknowledge any other blackfellas in the room, and I'm seeing a lot of deadly faces in the crowd, and I feel really, feels really special to be up here with everyone that I am. I'm going to get us all to introduce ourselves, and then we're going to get into it. Truth be told, I just wanted to see everyone here. It's been a minute, not mum. So, I'll talk a bit about why we're all on stage in a bit. But Amy, why don't you kick us off, sis?
Okay, I'd also like to acknowledge the continuing sovereignty of Gadigal Mob and all First Nations people all across the country. I'm a Darumbal and South Sea Islander woman from Rockhampton in central Queensland, and was fortunate to grow up on my traditional country, work, learn, know so many mob up there. So that's basically me, and I've been a journalist for the past 15 years, just mainly working in Aboriginal affairs and currently doing my PhD under Chelsea. So that's basically me.
So I'm Chelsea Wadigo. I'm a visitor to this place, so I want to acknowledge Gadigal Mob that are here and Gadigal country. I'm an associate professor at the University of Queensland in the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Studies Unit. I work in health, kind of, but I'm interested in race and have some things to say about it at times.
Not at times.
And I'm a mum to 5 really cool people.
Hey, woman, jindi netta makta rani gori. I'm Gunai Kurnai. My pronouns are she and her. I'm Naika's mum. I want to pay my respects to the elders, past and present, on the stolen lands that we gather today, the Gadigal people, and pay my respects to any elders in the room. And I know there's a couple. Thank you.
Deadly, it's mum.
Thank you, darling.
I'm Nayuka. I'm also Gunai, Kurnai, Gunajamara, Raja and Yorta Yorta. So also, as Chelsea said, a visitor here. And I'm, a writer. And also a mother of 2. They're here. They'll probably carry on to get on stage at some point. And you'll just have to deal with that, because this is how blackfellas go. Firstly, well, Michael asked me, festival director, to guest curate. And I initially was really overwhelmed, because I was like, oh, I don't know what to do. But then I was like, well, actually, who do I want to sit around and have a yarn with? And I've known all of these women for a long time, since I was a kid. Ronnie is my oldest friend. And I'm also affiliated with everyone, family members, and have been a part of communities. So it made a lot of sense for me, as someone who looks up to Amy, Chelsea and Ronnie, my mum, that we'd all sit on this panel together. And I thought, well, these are the women I want to speak to, so what are we going to speak about? So I thought, who do I want to yarn to? And then I was like, what should we yarn about? As if I can control what anyone says up here, these wild black women. But something I thought that we all kind of had in common was, in a way, that we're kind of Dories, in that we're watching this country. True, mum. We watch, we look, and we witness what this country does and is doing and has done. So I thought that might be a place to start from. So that's, I guess that's how Bearing Witness came to mind, and also the different pieces. Amy has written an essay on this, as well as other thinkers. There's a long history of black thought around what it means to witness stuff. And I thought, here in this moment, 2021, with all that we've been through, I thought it would be interesting to speak to that. Before we really get into it, though, I want to ease into it, because I recognise it's been a weird time. So I just want to know how everyone's actually doing. How are you going?
Great. I've got a few things to say, but I'm great. Other than that.
That's good.
Yeah.
All right. Deadly. Chelsea, how are you going? How are we meeting you?
A little tired. but at the same time motivated by the circumstances that creates that tiredness, which is kind of can be an unhealthy relationship, but part of, I think, what compels us to tell story as well. So yeah, a bit tired, but still same time turning up to say some stuff.
Yeah.
I think I'm okay. I think like it's been quite relentless over the past, obviously for a lot of people over the past year, but I feel like I'm in a place where, I don't know, particularly when we relate, talk about stories, I feel there are certain stories that are speaking to me in certain ways. So yeah, I'm in a weird place in my life where I'm really listening to the ancestors and what stories they're bringing me. So I'm in this weird place. So I think I'm okay.
Can I ask what's speaking to you at the moment?
There's a lot of things. I probably couldn't talk a lot, but there's a couple of stories just in Darumbal country, which I feel like particular responsibilities to. And there's just these weird, like I've been calling them strange coincidences. And there's so many things Chelsea knows a lot about, but they're just these weird coincidences that happen. And I realised just recently, I'm calling them strange coincidences to make them like palatable to white people, to make them understandable to white people. But they're not coincidences at all. They're just so many strange, weird things. And I feel like particularly there's some responsibility to people who have passed away, but their stories are still living on and their voices are still living on and their presence is still there. And there's ways that they speak to us, which sounds airy-fairy to other people, but it's, for me, it's just becoming very more evident and it's emerging.
One of the kind of funny yarns that we have around this is, does this belong in the thesis? If I can, you know, of going, this happened, but maybe that doesn't belong in the thesis. And like, no, it needs, like, in terms of the story around Indigenous knowledges, this is, because that's the stories that are coming and the way they're coming are just, you know, it's spirit speaking. And so it's like, no, but we have to find a way of telling this story on our terms around how we come to story. And so that's been interesting, having those yarns around, if that's okay to say it, about going, well maybe it doesn't belong in a thesis. And it's like, well, no, it's an essential part of the story.
Why shouldn't it be there?
Because we're disciplined about what is knowledge. And you know, we talk about Indigenous methodologies, but in the being of it, it's, I don't think the Academy is used to actually hearing us tell how we come to know things in the way that we come to know them, because it's very unfamiliar to them, given they're so disconnected from this place.
Well, like, happy to speak about it from an anthropological point of view, but not happy when it's lived and breathing and right there and telling them to fuck off or something. Are you sure you're just okay?
Oh, I'm exhausted, to be honest.
Yeah, there it is.
I am exhausted. So prior to, for the last 13 years or 10 years, however long, I've been on a gag order from the Queensland Police. And still I'm on a gag order. There's certain things I can't speak about or write about because of this gag order. But also when you write a book and when they get your book and you're under contract, you're on a gag order yet again. So for the last 2 years at Scribe, I've had my book. I couldn't talk about anything that's in the book. So, but now all that gag order's off. So I'm quite vocal on Twitter, and when I do get that platform, I do speak up and I speak loud and I swear a lot. So if anyone's offended, I apologise. But I don't give a fuck anyway. But yeah, so I swear a lot. So if anyone's offended, take it as you will.
Fuck off, Nakim. Also, this is an aside, but is it, well, no, it's related. Is it weird? I remember when you were on the, like, you couldn't speak to things because, like, in a sense it was commercial property or not property, you know what I mean? Was it weird not being able to talk about your own stuff?
Yeah,
like,
and also,
a thing that happened to you, a story that you own, you can no longer, like, from both the police and, you know, publishing companies. It's also not just Scribe. Love Scribe, but
it's not Scribe. It's all it's
like,
publishing
well, why
a book.
Would people buy the book
yeah,
if you
so
just...
you're under contract. So, and I probably shouldn't have mentioned my publishers in that regard.
No,
but
Mom,
yeah,
no,
but
right.
Yeah, it's just that gag or it's like they have the rights and you can't talk about it. So when Naika wanted to tweet stuff or you wanted to raise certain, like, raise issues or stuff or mention me, you had to question, is it okay to talk about this? And there were times I said, no, you can't, because it's in my book. But that's how it is. And so I'm off the leash now, so to speak, and I go for it. So
look out, world.
Yeah.
Here she is. You also nodded to that, Chelsea, the silencing stuff.
I think people have this idea that black women are outspoken, and yes, we are, but they don't realise the violence being visited upon our bodies in the course of trying to speak and to speak to your own experience. So, you know, I've had any number of defamation threats. I've had to find a way to secure our home for my children so that people can't sue me because I spoke a truth about my experience. There are things that, you know, I'm currently finishing my book and I have areas that are for redaction because I may not be able to speak about certain things. And so I don't think people realise that in the course of the truth-telling, they're still, like, standing on our necks. They're still, like, holding us down and we're still screaming out these stories. And so I think people don't understand that when they see that moment of, like, going Esther, for instance, it comes from a place. And in a moment where they're still exercising the full weight of their power upon us, and that's the thing what I love about black women in particular when it comes to bearing witness is we are the most truthful, we're the most courageous, and we put our bodies on the line. And you know, we reading your book, we feel that's how much that your body had to carry. And even in the course of telling the truth about that, I don't know how doing that tour of your book and having to retell and what that does. I think there's something empowering about externalising that it's not your fault. This is what happened. This is the account of what happened to me, but it's not my fault. But the labour that's involved when black women tell the truth about what it is to be in this place, truthfully, fully, to the extent that we legally can, it's fucking hard.
I felt that too when I read your book, Ronnie, particularly the bits about the police. Like, there were parts where I just had to put it down because the brutality of what we know about the police service, but particularly from your position inside the police service and just the way it was just continuing and was so relentless. So, you know, there were times I had to put down your book, but I thought it was such a powerful testimony because of those silencing tactics. And also Aboriginal women are so often blamed for perceived silences, even when we speak out. You know, we're told we're silent about violence, and that's misused against us. But there are reasons, and sometimes silence can be a resistance too. There's reasons why women might not speak out. There are ways that, you know, silence can be... There's all these different resistances shown by Aboriginal women that I saw in your book in so many ways, not just as you were growing up in your relationship, but also in the police service, that just stood out to me so much, and they're never recognised by white Australia. In fact, they're used against us. Not just by media, but by politicians, but by the structures. You know, when we see in the prison system and the police system, and we don't hear stories because there is a deliberate silencing of mob who've been incarcerated. You know, because I'm seeing that now in, you know, the inability we have to raise certain voices because of these huge, violent structures that are intent on suppressing the truth. And then blackfellas are seen as unreliable anyway. You know, even though when I look at the police and I looked at your account, you know, all of the evidence is stacked against police. We have report after report coming from Queensland. We had the Fitzgerald inquiry. Yet police are still seen as the good fellows. You know, the guards are still seen as the good fellows. The evidence shows that it's actually the opposite. And yet the evidence is stacked against blackfellas and seen as unreliable witnesses.
And the other thing is the reliable witness around telling the truth about the violence black women experience is always the white woman. Whether it's Nanette Rogers, you know, it's always Kathy McLennan. It's always the white woman who can tell a truth about our experience, but we can never be trusted. And maybe sometimes there's room for our testimony, but never theory. But even then, they know what's best. We look at the Task Force for Coercive Control in Queensland right now, and the way in which Aboriginal women appear in the terms of reference as potential victims and perpetrators. You know, like, so they get to know us and then define us both as the problem as well, and the threat in their supposed care for us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a thing.
It's a big thing.
I'm sorry.
This is history, Mum. We're on a panel together. Amy, I want to pivot to you because I see you speaking about Mum, but also and Chelsea, but you're not. You also do amazing work yourself. I'm really interested to know, like, your work, and I'm not sure once again how much you can legally speak to it, but your work has played a role in, like, moving like real world things. I often think of like sometimes with writing, I'm like, oh, you know, who cares if we write the thing? Like, whatever, it doesn't matter. But then I'm like, actually, no, the things that you do have changed the world and have changed individuals' lives. And I wondered, say with Curtin, for example, like when you started writing and also podcasting, did you have any ambition beyond just telling the truth? Or were you like, oh, maybe this will do something? Or was it just imperative to you, like, I need to tell this story? Or like, not I need to tell this story, but this story needs to be told, and if I don't do it, I might set myself on fire or something. Like, yeah.
I think the story was secondary, because there was two reasons, is that there was a victim in this case who was an Aboriginal woman, and that was a really hard thing for me to do, because I felt if you're going to go looking back at this old story which happened in 1991, you're dredging up the violence that was perpetrated against her, not just on the riverbank in Rockhampton, but also by the media and the really dehumanising way they described her, or just the complete apathy they showed to her, but also in the way the courts described her. And literally they didn't describe her at all. She was pretty much absent except for the wounds on her body, which were used obviously for the case, but misused. So there was that. You can't do a story in which you're going to perpetrate, I felt, by redoing it, you are going to hurt her, but also her family. But then there was the other case where we had very strong evidence within a month of looking into it that the man who had been convicted over her death was innocent. And so before we even looked at the story, we had to have a good case that we had evidence to show. So it wasn't like this true crime podcast where it was like entertainment, will they or won't they? For those two reasons, these were real people. And so it wasn't even about doing a podcast at first. We were thinking of the ways we could use the media to get Kevin out, because we knew straight away. And one of the reasons I knew he was innocent was because my dad had been an Aboriginal prison guard in Etna Creek, where Kevin had served the majority of his sentence for like 30 years. For the majority of my time.
Your dad was at Edna Creek.
Yeah, and so he had known Kevin. He had known Kevin for like, since Kevin was 17. And about in 2000 or something, 2002, 2003, Kevin and dad had been alone in the airlock, and this was one of the only places in the prison where you were away from surveillance or any form of surveillance. And Kevin had just looked up at dad and said, no, I didn't do this crime. Like a policeman held a gun to my head and forced me to confess. And so for me, knowing my dad and knowing him all my life, and dad knowing Kevin, and dad always, he'd been on duty the night Kevin had been convicted, and the guards had come to him and said, and they were white redneck guards, they said, oh, we don't know about this one, because they sat in on all the trial, and they thought, nah, there's something dodgy going on here even then. So the fact that dad straight away believed Kevin, because he felt Kevin was reliable, and I felt Kevin was reliable, and then all of that evidence came afterwards. So we had to know that there'd been this injustice before we even looked into it, mainly because of the victim. And I felt like there'd been enduring injustice, but I also felt it was that enduring injustice that had led me to that case. So it was very much the fact that Kevin was still incarcerated at the time. And he had health problems. We were concerned, you know, he wasn't getting the help he needed. We were concerned he would never get out at all. You know what I mean? So there were all these other reasons to do the story. And responsibilities we had to do it properly. Yeah. Which I think is why, yeah, it was more about getting Kevin out first. Yeah, and that was like the method to do it in a way.
That's far out. I'm just thinking of all those poxy podcasts that are like, you know what I mean? They're like that, yeah, entertainment, like the people's lives being used for entertainment. One of the reasons why I was interested, or I'm really interested in the idea of witnessing, even like if I see people being arrested on the street, like I'll stop and I'll watch what's happening, because police behave differently when they're being watched. Sometimes, not always. Well, it happened a couple of weeks ago. There was this fella on Elizabeth Street in Melbourne getting arrested, and I stopped and I was like, oh, brother, are you okay? Because he, like, you know, you just never know what's going to happen. And then he was like, tell me to fuck off. So I was like, fair enough. Sometimes it backfires. But when people are being watched, they do behave differently. But I watched I'm Not Your Negro a couple of years ago, which was about James Baldwin and, you know, some of his work. And he talked about the role that he saw himself playing as a writer. And that was of someone who was, he wasn't up on the podium speaking. He wasn't like out, you know, throwing Molotov cocktails. Can you imagine though? He saw his role as a witness, or someone to corroborate reality. And I guess I'm really interested in this idea of like our reality being corroborated. It's like this idea that stuck with me. Like reading your book, Mum, was a bizarre feeling because it actually changed my reality because, you know, our family was being written about and there were things that I had remembered that I'd remembered wrong or that I hadn't like gotten the details right. But I'm interested in, I haven't actually asked you this before, but I'm interested to know.
Go, yeah.
Like, it was one thing to write it, but why did you decide to publish it? Because it's one thing to see something and to see what's happening in front of you, and then it's another thing to tell someone about it. So I'm just, why did you get it published?
I don't know. I think it's, like, recorded, like, evidence. You know, I'm leaving my legacy for you kids and my grandchildren and their children. I think as black people, black women, we need to do that. You know, like I've looked at your great-grandmother's ward files from the state government and the fucking disgusting language that they used back in that day, and probably still today, it's absolutely horrendous, you know, it's terrible. And I wanted to rewrite that history and document it, and as well as me losing my memories. Yeah, so I wanted my memories captured so that I never forget.
There's they don't like it when we speak back to the archive, do they?
No.
Another thing that I'm really interested in is that I've been thinking a lot about like the truth and whose truth matters and who is seen as telling the truth. And at the same time, I've also been reading almost exclusively the work of black women. And for me, it's like, I was saying this before, I feel like when I read black women, whether it's like Melissa Lukashenko's stories, whether it's Evie, who's also in the crowd, her poetry, I feel like I'm reading the truth. I'm reading the truth of this place. And so I want to know, like, is that a shared feeling with everyone?
Yeah, but
and what is it about us that that means we're telling the most truth, if that can be a thing?
Yeah, but also, like, when we do speak up and we do tell the truth, we're not the best witnesses. Like, if there's a crime, they're not going to call us up as, you know, to give evidence because we're not believed.
We're considered unreliable witnesses.
Yeah, unreliable and biased as well. But, yeah, and like what you were saying, Chelsea, earlier, for us to get up and actually speak up and speak out, we're always deemed as angry, which is fucked up. I probably am angry, though. But,
but that's,
you know,
good.
There's a lot of
angry,
things.
What's, and, wrong with anger?
Yeah, yeah. And it's like, and what I was, I was on a panel yesterday and I explained to the Gubs that when blackfellas get a platform, whether they're musicians, artists, actors, writers, whatever, we get that platform. We speak for all our mob. We don't just speak for ourselves.
Well, there is one person on Twitter that we are not
speaking
for.
Can I say, like, I think I first, coming to academia as a researcher,
yeah.
I felt compelled to show the truth as I knew it, and to correct the account. And I thought if I learnt the tools that they used and if I could produce the evidence base, that somehow that would be emancipatory. And, of course, Audre Lorde said the master's tools never dismantle the master's house. What I'm interested now in truth-telling is not in an appeal to whiteness to see us, to see our truth, but to speak to blackfellas about and reminding us who the fuck we are, where we come from. Because race, in its violence, insists that we accept a whole lot of lies about who we are every day. And sometimes we have to accept them in order to navigate the world for a minute. We have to entertain the violence of the lies that race tells us to continue to live in this place, right, at some level. So I'm no longer exhausting my labour on appealing to a people whose existence is predicated upon me not existing, because it's tiring work. And they don't believe us anyway, no matter how sophisticated our tools are, no matter how articulate our storytelling is. The power of the black story and the real black story is the story that's told to black people by black people. But there's not a market for that in literary festivals. The black non-fiction books are all about black problems and the solution. They're always authored by white people. And it's a literary genre. Which people are making a whole lot of money out of. And the Academy is built off this idea. And so for the few of us that sit here as black non-fiction writers, it's an area that we have to push to exist in, because they like us to tell the stories about ourselves, but not the fucking truth.
Yeah.
And that's the power of the black non-fiction and the need to support that. Not to say it's an either-or, but there is an imbalance here around Indigenous authorship and the kinds of stories that have a market that find themselves on bookshelves.
I'm just interested to know, like, because I think about like archives, and I've spoken to Evie about this before. I think it was Evie, like, who's in the... I keep pointing that way, it's because that's where she's sitting. Like, this idea that there's an archive... And, like, we stumble across the truth. Like, when we start looking for stuff, like, you started looking in Nanny's, like, government archive and saw the lies. But every, you know, we look through our fiction, we look through our non-fiction, we look through transcripts or whatever it might be, and we stumble across this stuff and see the truth. I'm interested to know when was the first time that happened to you and you realised you'd stumbled across something really, like, I need to hold on to this thing?
I don't know. I couldn't pick, like, the first time. I'm just
or
trying to
something
think.
That sticks out.
I mean, this is... I don't know if this directly is... I mean, it's sort of in the archive, but it's just something I think about all the time, and it's because, you know, everyone knows the Palm Island case, but I recently revisited it. And I was reading, like, the recent racial discrimination case, and I've, like, told this to a million people, so... But what I found in the case was it's so interesting. Like, I went back and was just looking at the original witness statements and everything like that, but particularly the black witnesses. And there was three black witnesses to what, you know, Mulrunji, who saw Mulrunji before he died. You know, there was a lady outside the watch house, there was a man inside the watch house, and there was the Aboriginal police liaison officer. All of them came from different perspectives, not just where they were, but also from how they were viewing it. So the woman was sort of seeing it from both sides, the man inside was seeing it a different way, and the police liaison officer was a bit fearful. But they all pretty much corroborated their own accounts by not speaking to each other. And they saw Hurley fall on... they saw Hurley bashing into Mulrunji. That was before any other further investigation and everything like that. So you had these really three witnesses who could be completely relied upon, but they're continually just disregarded, and we still have this complete version, police version of accounts around a fall. But when I was reading back into that case, you know, the police versions of events around the uprising, they kept talking about these imaginary spears, that there were these spears there. And the judge
was nowhere to be found.
Well, they kept talking about spears, like there were mob outside with spears. And the judge in the racial discrimination case went and he said, I'm looking at all the video evidence, there are no spears there, but the spears were used to justify the uprising. And I'm like, so where did these imaginary spears come from? Because I'm like, have they just made them up? Like, did they actually see these spears? And I'm like, white people can't be relied upon as reliable witnesses when it comes to this. But then you have those three witnesses who saw Mulrunji, and they're all completely solid and reliable. And they never saw a fall, they saw a bashing. You know what I mean? And so when I was looking back, I just got really fixated on these spears and the fact that they were never there. But there's that account of the Palm Island uprising where there's spears, always spears.
And what does it tell you about the white imagination and the white psyche that they saw spears?
Yeah, I don't know if they actually saw them. They made it up, but I reckon they saw them. Like, I think they saw a mob with spears. There was
maybe the ancestors were there with spears.
Well, maybe. I don't know. Like, but I just got fixated on those spears. I'm like, where did these spears come from?
Like, well, how?
Yeah, sorry. So I don't know if that, like, was, like, answering a question, but that's something that is just, like, looking back on a story I'd, like, looked at so many times before and just seeing that and going, wow, like... Yeah, just being blown away about stuff like that.
That's wild. Thank you for sharing that. Chelsea?
Well, so you remember back before the internet, when I was in school and you'd have like your assignment and it'd be about like a country or whatever, we had like the 1970s World Book Encyclopedia. It was secondhand from someone else that was on our bookshelf. If I couldn't rely on that, I would go to the news agency and they'd have those trundle things with the cards, the glossy cards with each country. And so you'd buy the card and you'd cut it out and put on some cardboard and you'd do your assignment about, you know, different countries and things.
Ancient Egypt.
Yes, ancient Egypt. Well, it turns out there's also the ancient Aborigines on those same trundle cards. So I remember growing up and seeing the Aborigine in the news agency. In a story that was told that was so far removed from what I knew myself to be. And so I remember as a child seeing the Aborigines, or what they said were the Aborigines, in while I was in my body as one. And it is this kind of dispossessing feeling, right, when you see an account of you that has nothing to do with your reality. But fast forward, I think it was like first year at uni, and I'm at the Queensland Museum bookshop. And I see a picture of my great-grandmother on the front cover. I'd never seen the photo, but I knew it was her. Portrait of Our Elders, Michael Aird's book, whose countryman you can bear. And it was this, Du Bois talks about a peculiar sensation. It was a peculiar sensation to see my great-grandmother recognised as not just an ancient Aborigine, but an elder in a portrait. And to pick that up and take that with me. And I've had to buy a million copies since because people steal them and they're hard to get. So no, you can't borrow it. It's always reminded me about the importance of the black storyteller in terms of for the black audience and how the stories we tell of ourselves not just nourish and affirm, but they're not dispossessing. Like we're here, we're still here. And this is the terms in which we exist in. And so I saw these gorgeous portrait pictures of my great-grandmother and her siblings and the story of how, we knew the oral story, but captured in a book.
You hadn't,
in a book that my kids can read. But I hadn't
seen
that photo.
Before.
But I knew it. And I rang Mum and went. And so, yeah, there's just something. I remember that moment.
Mum?
What was the question again, Soda?
No, fair.
Sorry, we both went on.
Yeah, no.
Just, you and Uncle Crippy are like this. Like, what's some memorable moment where you looked through history or even contemporary times and saw an account by blackfellas, or it could even, like, the imaginary Spears case? Curious incident of the imaginary Spears. Yeah, where, like, you've seen us in print and it's just something that sticks out to you.
Oh, just, I can't think because of them babies.
I know, I'm lactating.
Oh, no.
I get it, I'm not. Time has passed.
Oh, I can't think.
Well, you looked through Nanny's archives.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And you knew that they were lies.
Yeah, and...
But you also, you read black women as well. I remember growing up. There were always, like, when you were at uni and other times, there were books in the house. There was also...
Okay, I'll go back to the ward files. When I got my dad's ward files, like, when I read that, I found out who Dad's biological father was, you know, so that was a bit hard to read. Yeah, and it turned out he was alive the whole time and living up Sydney, but, We always...
We got family up here.
Yeah, and they might be fucking rich.
We might be Gadigal naked.
No, they're Gabbals naked, but we might be wealthy here. We never knew about anything about your grandfather's biological father. And because Nanny didn't speak about it, so it wasn't till after she passed that I found out all this information.
Mm.
Yeah, it was really weird, yeah.
That would have been weird. I think some moments for me, like speaking of Nanny, because I knew, like, our mum's grandmother, my great-grandmother, oh, Bubba, you're right, darling. Okay, nap time, yep, deadly, love yous.
Yes, also, I'll go back. So my grandmother told, she did tell her story to Uncle Crippy, who you just said before, and she told him that he there was an explosion on the ship and that he died. And so we...
Who died? What?
Your biological great-grandfather, the one that's up...
Yeah.
And it turned out, I found out after my grandmother passed, that he'd been alive the whole time. And she didn't know that, and had she known...
She didn't know?
No, she thought he was dead, because there was an explosion on the ship.
Oh, so she... this fella was just avoiding child payments.
Tell her I blew up in an explosion, yeah.
I'm dead. Anyway... I find, like, family trees, those moments when, like actually seeing yourself and where you belong in the world as much as you can belong in the world, like, on a page, like, oh, this is who I am. These are my people. This is how I relate to these people. And I always heard growing up, always knew Nanny's story of, like, having to marry Granddad so that she could get Papaduck back, your dad back. But it wasn't until I saw the photos, like actually saw the photos where he looked miserable.
Yeah.
Because he was doing Nanny. Yes. No, I mean, they fell in love and it was...
Well, eventually, because they were married for over 40 years. But I have a wedding photo of my grandparents, and if anyone that's read my book will know that my grandmother was...
By the book, it's outside.
My grandmother was told to marry before she could get my father back. Because he was removed when she gave birth to him. But, so she went down back to the mission and on a mission, and she found this deadly fella. But, so she's smiling up in this wedding photo, but he looks fucking miserable, eh?
No, he does.
Hell.
She's
like, she would have walked up and said, oh, you got a woman? And he would have said, no, well, you have now.
Hey. Yeah. No, love him. No, he was really special. But for me, it was like seeing those photos made me actually understand the full weight of history and like the full weight of what happened, like what it looked like. The other thing that really stuck out to me was reading Nanny's files, because yes, there are Department of, you know, Child Safety, Human Services, Welfare Boards, whatever, you know, the modern iteration of stealing kids is now. They write about us. So there are, you know, pages and there are millions of pages dedicated to writing about us in a, you know, governmental archives. But in that time, when you got Nanny's folders, there were also letters that she had written. Yeah. And that was so, like, for me, that was like realising the power of archives. That was it for me, because I saw Nanny writing. They had kept writing letters she'd written to like the board or to friends or Auntie Myra, her sister, where she talked about like getting on the charge and like in Fitzroy. And I was like, I get on the charge in Fitzroy. It's ancestral. No, Kev. like just these writings of a like teenager that were kept, and that made me realise like how much we need to keep this stuff that we need to witness or talk about ourselves in that way. But
yeah, and that's a mistake the Victorian government did, and all over so-called Australia, they're documenting these records, because without these records, black fellas wouldn't be able to prove that we were stolen, and that's the evidence we have.
Absolutely. Chelsea, before you talked about, so I'm interested in kind of circling back to the idea of reliable or unreliable witnesses and the way that blackfellas can treat each other in determining who is reliable and who is unreliable. And I might start with you, Mum.
Okay, we're going back to me.
Yeah. Well, we were having a yarn before. We were having a yarn before because you were a police officer for 10 years, so you got to decide who is a reliable witness, who is unreliable. And you were a blackfella deciding these things. And, your father is a... Screw, like, we got to have yarns, but I'm just interested to know, like, how did you decide who was reliable another blackfella?
I relied on I believed them first. They were my best witnesses. But also I knew that they weren't going to... Because they were trustworthy. Like, to me, they were, for me. But, I didn't believe a word Gabbaz was saying, but...
Why?
Yeah, but also...
But
no, But in the job, I wasn't reliable to them. Like, I was just there. Yeah. I was just making up the numbers. You know, the tokenistic black person in the police. And I knew they didn't want to see. But we joined with good intentions. But once we're in, we weren't looked after. And a lot of things that I was subjected to and a lot of things that I did witness, I put in complaints, but they weren't taken seriously.
Yeah.
Because I'm black. Yeah.
I always find it interesting, like, the way that you are treated is, like, pales completely in comparison to the way, like, civilians were treated. But it's like, we can only imagine how fucked up it was. Chelsea, you exist, part of your life is in the ivory towers of the academy and not just, like, you're, like, in a sandstone university, which... is like, yeah, but like a big part of the way that we are constructed as a people in like the colonial and white imagination has been through the academy. They have created knowledges about us. And as black fellows have entered the academy more, we've in a way, I think, become complicit in the stories that are told about us. So I'm interested in your perspective on, like, who... I just want to know what you think about that.
Well, the ivory tower I live in as, a race scholar isn't as fancy, I think, as I think many of my colleagues have.
Dungeons.
I'm in this interesting building in a floor with the crop scientists with my $1.8 million research grant that has a health humanities agenda that belongs neither in the health faculty or the humanities faculty. So if you choose to tell a story that refuses to adhere to the violent one that these institutions insist you tell, they will let you know your place. There's no question of that. And so literally, I mean, on that floor we say, so what did you do to get to land here on this floor? Even with the research investment, even with the standing, even with the research impact, and I think a lot of our mob have thought if we were just better at telling the story, if our tools were more scientifically rigorous, if we were just better academics, then we would find our rightful place and then be able to have the weight of authority that the rest of the academics have. That race doesn't work like that. Spoiler alert.
Doggies.
Don't waste your energy, or at least use it on the people who are most deserving of it, I would say. So we believe that at some point we will be deemed a credible witness. We never will be, but that's okay. It doesn't mean we stop telling the story. We just got to remember who we're telling it for, why we're doing the work for.
Who we're talking
there for.
To.
I'm not doing it to be in the centre of an institution that welcomed the Ramsey Centre for Western Civilization. I'm not there for that. That's not my life goal. I think we have to recognise there's a price to be paid for telling our stories and being of service to our people. And white fellas get real damn indignant when you refuse to be of service to them, particularly when you're a black woman, particularly when that relationship has always been one of domestic service. Mm. And when you don't, they let you know. And there are black fellas too that subscribe to that violence who do want to be at the top of the ivory tower. And this is the violence of the academy right now, and that's why with the research work that we're doing, and Amy's a part of that on this research grant, is building a collective of black intellectuals who are not trying to reach the heights of the ivory tower, but that are committed to doing the intellectual work to burn the fucking thing down. That's what we're here for. That's why our stories are here. What do I think?
Go on, then.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. Yes.
Well, as a journalist, like, I think we can apply similar... Like, you are a journalist.
Mm.
And, like, the role we see journalism playing in society is that of the objective truth teller and, like, fly on the wall thing. But it gets murkier when we are talking about black journalists because they, like, white people and, like, whiteness as a power structure cannot see us as objective, because to be objective, like, you know. So I'm interested to know, as a journo, like, in what, similarly in the academy, how you see people, I guess, not challenging the story or whatever it might be, or what happens when you do tell the truth that doesn't sit well with the story or whatever it might be.
Yeah, I think because there's always a lot of conversation around, like, putting blackfellas in mainstream media newsrooms, and I always think that's the wrong way to go. I think we should be building up a completely independent black media force, because I just see our aims and just our whole purpose is fundamentally different. Mm. You know, like, in journalism, you're sort of separate. You're like the fourth estate. You're separate from, supposed to be. With blackfellas, like, we're actually part of activism, or supposed to be. Like, that's the whole point of like black journalism, I think, is to be almost like a tool for activism.
Yeah.
Or to, exactly what Chelsea was saying before, be for blackfellas. You know what I mean? That's like the main agenda. You're writing for blackfellas. And that's just not the focus a lot of the time. And I see it in the way stories are either framed or spoken of, who gets quoted, but also just the stories that are going untold. Mm. And, like, we talk about the police. And, like, just to add on to what you're saying, like, the prisons, the stories in the, to show how brutal and how violent the actual prisons are right now and who the perpetrators are in prison are just not being told. But there's reasons for that, because there are ways that they're keeping it silent. There are ways they're keeping the footage out.
Mm.
But we know about what's happening, well, and occasionally it comes out.
It was like seeing...
The prison, you know, they're so violent in that sense. And, you know, but there's so many stories all over country, you know, all over the nation that aren't being told, but because they can't see them, you know what I mean? So I feel like just having that resourced black media that has a completely different purpose is where it should be. So I don't really engage in debates about, like, mainstream or putting mob in mainstream media, because I just think it's the wrong focus, because I think it's always going to be about that. I think it's always going to be about making black stories palatable to white people. And it's just, it's not going to change anything. It just doesn't. You know what I mean?
And the question is, like, why is Alison Whittaker live tweeting these criminal inquiries? Why isn't Channel 9 News there? Why isn't mainstream media reporting it?
But she's doing it in a different way. She's doing it in a way that, you know, actually ensures that Wayne Morrison and his family have a voice and that we remember him, but also expose what's actually happening in the legal system. There's no one else doing that. You know what I mean? It's being done on Indigenous X and through Twitter. No one else is doing that. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, so... I think it has to be a whole fundamental... I just don't see mainstream media as equipped at all to actually tell black stories properly.
No.
You know, there are occasional good journalism, but we never see... I mean, we haven't seen a cop or a prison guard held to account yet. You know what I mean? So they're actually, like, black media has to be in service of communities, you know, not constantly have this... I don't know. Yeah, it's actually, like, a tool. It should be a tool, I think.
Like, something I'm finding... This is an aside... Channel 7, an executive at Channel 7 in charge of Channel 7 Queensland is an alleged war criminal. And I just find it really interesting that there have been a lot of stories coming out from Channel 7 in Queensland about how black children are really deviant.
I mean, that recent story which had, you know, what was it about? They're sending cops into kindergarten.
But they want to do
footage of black kids.
Yeah.
But this was the proposal put forward. The media covered the Queensland Police Union doing a summit on the day of the 30th anniversary of the Royal Commission into Deaths in Custody. And the criminologists were attending a police union forum on that day, and Channel 7 covered it and then had pictures of our kids suggesting that we should have cops in kindergartens. And then a week later, Queensland government passes legislation that is visited most violently upon black kids. So the complicity of academia, the media, all working in unison. And so those mainstream systems that are supposed to be objective and impartial are violent colonial projects.
And completely in collusion with each other.
Absolutely, in solidarity. So why would we want to be a part of those systems? Why would we want to do the work of those systems? That's the power of black storytellers and the power of the collective as blackfellas, of how we strategize around the violence of this place every day. Because we're clever. Like, and we can drag. Like, we've got skills. We're not just victims in this story.
No. No.
And that's the danger of the storytelling, is that it's one of powerlessness. No, like, watching Lex after that successful case, you know, laughing at that cop on the other side of the fence.
Cassie Richardson.
Yeah, I mean, that was... we also had to tell the stories of when we've won against all odds.
Yeah.
Or even, like, another, I think, a moment that should be absolutely preserved in the archives is when Sissy Girl, don't know her name, Pauline Hanson went and was talking to those young black girls, and she was like, I'm Indigenous! And then the girls were like, ugh. And they were like, well, she was like, well, where am I from or something? And Sister Girl was like, England. Like that for me, that is actually like one of the things that really inspired me about like bearing witness, because it's like one thing to bear witness, but also the audacity of black women to tell the truth, even when no one else will.
And like, yeah, that's true.
Me and Amy's sister Hayley, we found ourselves in that location at one point during conference, and we reenacted the whole thing. It was beautiful.
You were at the same place.
Yeah, yeah. We were later went like somewhat after, and then we reenacted the whole scenario. It was so powerful. Yeah.
And then you know what she did? Like this, all, I really want to find this because it brings me so much joy. When TikTok finally, really thinged, she had that video playing in the background, and then Megan Thee Stallion was also playing. She was like, we'll forever be that bitch. I was like, I fucking love you, sis. Where are you? You need your own show.
Also Queensland.
Yeah, of course. She's Of course.
Where else but Queensland?
Yeah. There's so much more that I wanted to talk about, but as I said, I wanted to catch up with everyone. So you've all just... watch just catch up. We've got some of the best frickin' minds up on stage right now, so want to throw to questions. We've got time for maybe one or two.
I can probably ask yous after, but for the benefit of everyone hearing the answer, Amy, you talk about black journalism needing to have its own space and needing to be independent. I'm so for that. It's so under-resourced at the moment. What can people hear who are not consuming our media by black journos, what can they do to help make sure that media one day can exist independently without commercial mainstream support?
I have no idea because I don't really know how to fund it properly myself yet. So
I believe you have a Substack or
yeah,
a Patreon.
Yeah, I'll see how I go with that. I'm trying to find like different ways to fund independent journalists. I have no idea because journalism's like, it's in strife already. You know what I mean? So I don't know. Yeah, I have no idea. Sorry, sis. I have no idea, honestly. Because, I mean, I think that's the question, eh? Like, how do you even save journalism in itself?
And, so. Like, journalism, like, what you do and what other black journos do, like, we really need it. Like, there are things, I think, that can only happen when they're brought to light in the way that you do it or the way that other black journos do it. So, like, Amy, if you can find a way to fund the work that Amy does, because as I said before, it literally changes the world. It, like, she did what the justice system and what police and prisons and the whole whatever system failed to do, and that was to see the truth and act on the truth. So this is work we need to fund. So I know that you're all rich white people, I can smell it. So if you can find a way, the only question you should be asking on the outside is, what are your bank details? So if you can find a way to do that. But something I forgot to mention before was you said like black, I think there's something to be said. Like, yes, black journos are mostly and often and should be for black people, often, you know, sometimes not. But white journos also do the same thing, like serve as propaganda for their own power structures.
Yeah,
so they're
true.
Not, yeah, I think true, yeah. White people are doing the same thing, but just on their side often. That was something I wanted to say. Good question, sis.
It's sort of actually related to the previous question, but firstly, thank you so much. It's a privilege to be here. I and many other people in the room were settlers, we're audience members, we're spectators. We are witnessing the witness and we are consuming Indigenous knowledge. So my question is around what your thoughts are on the ethics of consumption. So whether, you know, our responsibilities in consuming this knowledge, whether there can even be ethical consumption by us individuals, especially as we exist within these larger oppressive structures. Thank you.
Thank you. That is such a good question.
I think this is the beauty of Indigenous knowledges, though, as opposed to Western knowledges, if I can create that kind of separation, is you can learn without taking. You know, you can learn from without having to extract. You can pay for things and consume things without owning it and claiming it as yours or stealing it from others. You know, when we talk about our knowledge systems, my ability to know anything as a black fella, and Ian Anderson wrote this once about, you know, in Indigenous knowledges, our ability to tell a story is earned by explaining our relationship to that story. I can't know someone else's story, that's theirs. But if I want to talk about race, it's come from a place, from having experienced it. And not that experience alone is the thing that we weaponize against others who don't have it. Explains our relationship of how we came to know. So we can know things and we can not know things without feeling inadequate because knowledge is relational. Western knowledge has been used to steal land, to kill people. It has been, they've known to name and claim and take. And so it's about rethinking how we come to our relationship with knowledge and knowledge production. It doesn't have to be violent. Like, we have a knowledge system that isn't violent, it is relational, it is respectful. And we do it all the time. And black people have an ethics around Indigenous knowledge production, we just do it. You can't do the masterclass in it at uni, we just do it. And that's the power, I think, also of black scholarship, is to explain this, of a different way of knowing. That means you can learn, I can learn from your story, but I'm not going to take it and then use it and commercialise it and do all those kinds of things. I can just go, wow, I'm going to buy that book. So that you get credited for your knowledge that you produced. But I'm always going to cite you and respect you for what you did, for your story. Too often, particularly the things that black women have, are taken, are stolen from us. And they pass it off as theirs all the time. And so it's about not it's consuming it without taking it.
I related to that, something I've been thinking about a bit. So Terry Janke has a book, she's deadly. She has a book coming out sometime soon. But she got in touch because there was something that I'd written that was in the public domain, so she could have taken it and I would have been fine. But she asked me, can I use this? And I was like, oh my, Terry Janke wants to quote me? Yeah. I told my agent, I was like, you don't know what this means. And she didn't know what it means. she's white, that's fine. But it, like the way that she operated in her book versus the way that our stories have been, and we literally saw this on Twitter not that long ago with a black woman's life story being written about and told incorrectly by a white woman, that just, like, for me, that was, like, look at the way that black people treat each other, black people with integrity and who, like, are, like, strong culturally. Look at how they treat each other and, like, the respect that we give each other. And look how white people will literally steal your story and then tell it in the wrong way, which is probably the history of colonialism.
Didn't they even name the grandfather wrong?
That's anthropology, though.
You know, yeah, like, yeah.
It's what they do.
Yeah, why we're in this mess, white people. Did you have anything on the question?
No, that was brilliant. Yeah.
Mum, how can people ethically read or consume our stuff?
Oh, when you read my book, I want the reader to know that it's just my story. It's not every other black woman's story, which is what my opinion is what a lot of white people tend to do. They just assume that every black woman's been subjected to violence or sexual assault and all that stuff, but it's not. It's just my story, and I want the reader to know that not all Aboriginal men are abusive, because I've got amazing black men in my life, and I've raised an amazing black man.
Yeah, you guys are right.
Oh, you can clap that if you want. Yeah, I'm gonna.
Like, that kind of reminds me of the way that, like, people want to read you as a victim, or people might insist on reading you as a victim, and black men as the perpetrator and like frame our stories in that way. So I guess, yeah, as a reader or as someone who's consuming something, what are the assumptions you're taking into that, and how are you extracting from that, or how are you giving, or, you know, whatever it might be. Thank you so much. Can we give it up for these amazing Black women?
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe to and rate our channel wherever you listen to your podcasts.